Right, we'll be back in the book of Jude tonight. Jude, verse number 12. We'll pick up there. And we are right at the halfway point of making our way through Jude, if you look at it as far as numerically, according to verse number. We'll cover verses 12 and 13 tonight. Before we read our text, I want to say something just to say it, I guess. Maybe I'm sure you pretty well know everything I'm going to say, but I want to say it anyway. In light of things that we see going on in our country as of late, and I mean in the last few days, week or two, and then really in the last several years, 5 years or so, it's abundantly clear that those that believe in godliness and righteousness, and even unbelievers who believe in a biblical morality, not only are you silenced, but now they literally want you gone, and what you interpret gone, however you wish to interpret. That they mean it in any way possible. I think about what the Bible says in Proverbs 14, I think it's verse 34, righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. And that's where we're at. And I know everybody feels the need to point a finger somewhere. Everybody feels the need to raise a hand and say they've got a solution. And I don't know that I have a solution, and I don't intend to point a finger, but righteousness exalteth a nation, and we've lowered the bar and lowered the standard and lowered the bar again and lowered the standard again in this nation to where, I tell you, society is behaving like brute beast, like animals, living like dogs socially and behaving like dogs toward one another. And what we need to glean from what we've seen, let's just focus on the last couple of weeks, and really the last few days is the period of time it's been brought to our attention. But for example, the young lady that was stabbed to death on that train in North Carolina, you've seen that just like I have. And you can get divisive in the sense that you can pit conservative against liberal and Republican against Democrat and black against white and on down the line. And those are lines that need to be drawn, need to be distinguished. And I'm going somewhere else with this, so don't get nervous and panicked with what I'm saying in the next just couple of minutes. But there's a distinct difference between a Democrat and a Republican. And it ought to be acknowledged. It ought to be recognized. There's a distinct difference between liberals and conservatives. It ought to be acknowledged. There's a distinct difference between the black populace in America and the white populace in America. And it ought to be acknowledged. That's just the facts of the matter. That's the reality of it. And we could go into talking about the distinctions between all of those. We could talk about how Democrats are markedly always for evil. They're for murdering babies. They're for mutilating children's bodies and trying to turn them into something that God said biologically they are not. We could talk about how that 80% of the violent crimes committed by a segment of the population that only makes up roughly 18%. Which is the black populace. We could talk about that. That's facts that nobody wants to talk about. But I'm not trying to start a voting booth war, nor a race war, or anything like that. I'm getting to the greater point. The greater point is this. Instead of stopping at dividing the white folk and the black folk and the Democrats and the Republicans and all of those things, you know what we ought to see on a larger scale than any of those things? We ought to see that all of this demonstrates the brokenness of man, the depravity of man. And that's universal, Republican and Democrat, liberal and conservative, black and white. It's across the board. And ultimately, that's our problem. If we got rid of all the Democrats tonight, we'd still have a problem in America because you'd have a country full of sinful Republicans. And that's just the reality of it. Same between the races or any other of those lines of division that we talked about. At the end of the day, folks, it's a sin problem. It's a nature problem. It's a nature problem. Man is no more depraved than he's ever been, but he's no less depraved than he's ever been. Man is as wicked tonight as he was when he fell in the garden. He's equally wicked in exact proportion to what he was in the garden. And what you see over history, if you look over human history, you find where there were governments and empires, kingdoms, who at certain times contained and restrained the exhibition of that depravity. And then you find at times where governments and kingdoms and so forth didn't restrain that depravity. America used to be a country that restrained that depravity. There was enough morals in this country. Man was just as depraved. Don't think that when Andy Griffith was on air every day that people were less depraved. People were as depraved then as they are today. But the thing is, there was enough adherence to moral code within government and socially and otherwise that it kept things in check. But we have lost, our country has lost its moral compass from the top down. From the top down. I'll mess around and run rabbits if I'm not careful. Now, I should have already made my point and been in our text. Did you know today, when that young man in the prime of life was gunned down, and you may agree or disagree with what I'm about to say, and it doesn't matter. You've got as much right to your opinion as I do. But I've seen the actual video. I didn't see the video where you hear the gunshot, but the footage stops, and you just see him sitting there. I've seen the video where the bullet pierced his throat, and you've seen the blood gush out, and it looked like a scene where you would butcher a hog. And did you know, right on the heels of that happening, Congress was in session, and a conservative House member on the House floor asked, could we have a moment of silence just to honor this man whose life's been taken from him this evening? And would you believe that the Democrats, I don't know if it was every one of them, but a good number of them yelled out words of opposition. No, no, they didn't want to do that. We're in a terrible place when people who run the halls of Congress, people who are supposed to be our best and our brightest, our elected representatives, can't even muster up the human dignity. Even if you disagree with everything the man ever said, the human dignity just to recognize that this is a human life that was wrongfully taken, and I may disagree with everything he ever said, but I'm going to bow my head for 60 seconds just to acknowledge that there's a tragedy. And we can't do that anymore. We can't do that anymore. And it's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I'm reminded of something I heard Brother Ernest say some time ago. Somebody said in the presence of Brother Mitchell, Brother Billy Mitchell one time, said, God ain't doing anything. Well, you be sure of this, God ain't ever not doing anything. Brother Billy Mitchell responded, and he said, oh, yeah. I said, he's doing something. They said, what's he doing? He said, he's reprobating people. He's reprobating people. That's what he's doing. And I'm telling you, this is a dark hour that we live in. And I don't have the answers. If you were waiting on them, I don't have all the answers. I don't know what the thing's coming to as far as how it's all going to play out. But I'm telling you this, if there ever was an hour that God's people needed to recognize the exceeding sinfulness of sin, the depravity of man, and our need to get down on our knees and beg God to work in people's hearts and lives and work on behalf of our nation, it's the hour that we are living in right now. We need it more than we ever have. That's what I wanted to say in regards to that. Back to the book of Jude, where you've already found your place there. Verse number 12 and 13 is where we'll spend our time tonight. I want to go ahead and tell you now, it's 7:37, and that matters because I left my notes at the house. I have zero notes, and I preach my longest messages when I have no notes to keep me in check. So God bless you tonight, and I'm praying for you. But I told Brother Boozer earlier, I said, Brother, I've left my notes at the house. He said, well, just preach from the heart. I said, well, the heart will be better than the head because there's not much left in this head. So anyway, you be patient with me, but I'm going to share with you what comes to memory of our studies of these two verses. Verse number 12 says, these are spots in your feast of charity when they feast with you, feeding themselves without fear. Clouds they are without water, carried about of winds. Trees whose fruit withereth without fruit, twice dead, plucked up by the root, raging waves of the sea, foaming out their own shame, wandering stars to whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. So, he starts out in verse number 12, speaking of these. He says, these are spots in your feast of charity. These are they that we've been looking at throughout the entire book. You remember they were those certain men that crept in unaware in verse number 4. They're known as false teachers. In verse number 11, he talked about how they had gone after the way of Cain and after the era of Balaam and perished in the gainsaying of Korah. We looked at those over the last 3 weeks. These are the false teachers. And here's what he says about them in verse 12. He says, these are spots in your feast of charity. Now, what does that mean? They're spots. Well, I'm going to take a chance at this, but I want you to turn back, I think it's to 2 Peter chapter number 2 and verse number 13. And if I'm wrong, we'll go back to where we were. 2 Peter chapter 2. That's correct. 2 Peter 2 and 13. Now, Peter's dealing with the same crowd, by the way, in this part of 2 Peter. Matter of fact, in the whole of 2 Peter, he really deals with these false teachers. But here in 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 13, he says, and shall receive the reward of unrighteousness as they that count it pleasure to write in the daytime spots. Same word. Spots they are and blemishes, sporting themselves with their own deceivings while they feast with you. That's a parallel verse to verse number 12 here in the book of Jude. They're called spots in both, and in their time of feast is referenced in both. But it is two slightly different words, same English word, but two slightly different words in the Textus Receptus, the received text that our King James Bible is translated from. Over there in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 13, it literally means just that, a stain, a spot, a blemish. But here in Jude, where we're at in verse number 12, he says these are spots in your feast of charity, it really literally means rocks. It means hidden reefs or submerged rocks is what the word means. And that's important, and it's worth noting. He says these are spots in your feast of charity. The Feast of Charity, now, depends on what commentators you read after, what preacher you listen to. Some will tell you that was during the Lord's Supper. Then others will tell you that there was a meal that they had before the Lord's Supper, and that that's the meal that it was speaking of. That would be the direction that I would lean in the matter. But that's neither here nor there. What does matter is that they were spots in the Feast of Charity, and what that means is they were laying there unseen. Do you remember it said in verse number 4 that these certain men had crept in what? Unaware. And this word spots, which literally means hidden reefs or submerged rocks, they're there but unseen, unnoticed to the eye. And as the ship comes in, do you know what happens when there's hidden rocks, when there's reefs that you can't see? It's a great danger to the vessel, because they'll run up on them and they'll bust the hull of the ship and potentially sink the ship and take the lives of everybody on board. That's what he's talking about when he says these are spots in your feast of charity. Look at what he says they does. What they do when they feast with you, feeding themselves without fear. They're there at the love feast and they feed themselves without fear. Without fear of what? Well, first, without fear of God. Without fear of God. And I want to say this, if there's no fear of God present, there'll certainly be no fear of man present. And that could be applicable to some of what I said before we started our message tonight. Speaking about the situation in our country, if there's no fear of God present, you can believe there'll be no fear of man present. But that was the case with the false teachers. These men that's crept in unaware. They're in the love feast. They're mingled within that body of believers. They're hidden reefs. They're submerged rocks, but they're right below the surface, and they pose an imminent threat, an imminent danger to that body of believers there. And they just gather in among them without any concern, without any fear. It's literally a wolf meandering around among the flock of sheep as if he has a purposeful place there, as if he belongs there. That's the picture that's giving you here. Then he begins to describe them in further detail. Now, you've noticed already, Jude has a tendency when he makes a point, he makes the point and then he comes back and makes the point again with a different illustration. And he will always make the point the third time with a different illustration. This time he gives us examples, and he actually gives us more than three examples of what these spots, these false teachers, these men that crept in unaware, what they are. Here's what he says. He says, clouds they are without water. Clouds without water. What's the meaning behind that? What does that mean, clouds without water? Well, it's promises that never produce is what it is. That's what he's saying. They come in and they speak the language and they talk the talk, but they never get around to walking the walk. They put on a Christian facade. They've learned how to speak the language, if you will, but when it comes to putting it in shoe leather and walking it out in their day-to-day life, they're a cloud that looks very promising to deliver rain, but it never gets around to delivering a rain. Got no water in it. And that's the false teacher. Full of promises, but never produce anything. Clouds without water. He said, carried about of winds. Just drift to and fro. To and fro. And the Bible has some negative things to say about people that's carried about with every wind of doctrine. Second example, he said, trees whose fruit withereth. Now, in that part of the world, all of their fruit-bearing trees, or at least the very best of fruit-bearing trees, always produce their fruit in the fall of the year. That's different from here. We get much of our fruit in the spring. We get pears in the fall, and we get some apples in the fall, but predominantly we get our fruit in the spring of the year. But they would produce their fruit in the fall, the very best of fruit. Now, he said, trees whose fruit withereth. It means it starts to put on fruit. It buds. It blooms. It puts on a fruit. And everything looks promising. But before the fruit reaches maturity, before the fruit reaches the state where it would be consumable, something you could actually eat to give your body nourishment that you might benefit from it, it withers up. It withers up. He said, that's how the false teacher is. He said, they're like a cloud. It drifts around and looks like it's going to bring rain, but it never delivers on its promise. He said, they're like a tree that puts on a bumper crop of fruit, but before any of the fruit gets ripe, the rot starts to show up. The decay starts to show up. And it withers up. It literally dries up on the vine before it ever produces anything. He said, that's your false teacher. That's your men that creep in unaware. He said, whose fruit withereth up without fruit. They produce no fruit. He says that they're twice dead. Twice dead. What does that mean? Whether they're dead from the root, meaning they're dead from their nature, and they're dead in their fruit, they never produce. They never produce anything. One writer said one writer said they're dead from the root stock. He was speaking in terms of grafting trees. If I don't know if you're familiar with what it means to graft a tree, but that's a thing that's of interest to me is grafting trees. And you can take one apple tree that has a lot of disease resistance to it and longevity to it, and you can take the root stock from that. That means you take the roots and just you can buy it, literally buy root stock, and it'll be a little apple tree about that tall with the roots on it. And you take and you find another apple tree that you like the fruit off of, but it's susceptible to disease. You cut a limb off of the one that you like the fruit from, and you graft it onto the root stock of the other. You cut both limbs. They have to be close to the same diameter. You match them up. You match what's called the Camden layer. It's in between the wood and the bark. It's that green layer where all the nutrients flow. You match that up, and they mate, and they seal. And so you have root stock from one variety, but then the top part that produces fruit is from another variety. One writer spoke of it in those terms. He said the nature is corrupt, the root stock is corrupt. That's once dead. And then he said they're twice dead because the graft, the top half that's supposed to produce fruit, it won't produce fruit. It withers, produces no fruit. It's twice dead. What do you do with a tree that's twice dead? It's dead on bottom and dead on top. Never produces fruit. Look at what he says. Plucked up by the roots. Plucked up by the roots. That means utterly destroyed. He's speaking already in the latter part of verse number 12 here when he speaks of plucked up by the roots. He's already giving you a foreshadow of what's going to be said in the latter part of verse number 13 that we'll deal with in a minute when he speaks of the blackness of darkness forever. The blackness of darkness forever. He goes on describing them here. This is his third example. Raging waves of the sea, foaming out their own shame. Raging waves of the seas, foaming out their own shame. This is what you learn about the raging waves of the sea. Raging waves of the sea, they beat against the vessel, they threaten the vessel, but if you watch the raging waves of the sea, you can watch that wave travel for 100 miles. It may get as high as 10, 20 feet or more high. And it makes unbelievably vicious noise and sounds terribly threatening. But before it finishes its course, you know what it'll do? It'll play out. It'll lay low. It'll turn to nothing and be foam on the beach. It's the same picture repeated again. We told you Jude does that. He makes the same point with different examples. This is his third example. What he's saying is the wave don't produce fruit. It talks a good game, if you will. It says a whole lot, but it does absolutely nothing. And then the fourth and final example that he uses, and by the way, on the raging waves of the sea, says foaming out their own shame. That's what they always do before it's said and done. I wish I remembered things as well as I ought to. But I've got a good excuse. I don't have notes with me. Brother Burns? Is that who the pastor was here, Brother Ernest, that told you every man before he gets out of this world will show what was the exact quote? Give me that if you don't mind. Before he gets out of here. God will, every professed believer, God will reveal what he truly is before he gets out of here. That's Brother W.W. Burns, pastor here, who said that. That's what Jude's telling us about these false teachers when he compares them to these raging waves of the sea, foaming out their own shame. I mean, they roar and they carry on 100 miles out at sea and 50 miles out at sea and even 200 yards from the shore. But when it's said and done, They fizzle out and they fade out and show nothing but their fame, and their foam and their filth and their disgust. And all the nastiness of what the wave contained is found in the foam of the wave. And so then finally, and fourthly and finally, he speaks of the wandering stars. Wandering stars, to whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. The wandering stars. Now, I know you probably don't read a lot of commentators, but I like to read a lot of different commentators on just about anything that I'm going to touch on, because that's a, it's a very good way to get a lot of different angles on a text. Here's what I learned. Even among some so-called conservative commentators, when they talked about these wandering stars, you know what they'd say? They'd say things like this. They would say that in Jude's day, their knowledge of how the planets work and how everything's kept in order and the exactness of all of that was foreign to them. And so they really didn't mean wandering stars. What they meant was planets. Well, no. See, Jude didn't write this book. God wrote this book, and Jude held the pen. And if God said wandering stars, I reckon he meant wandering stars. And do you know what the wandering stars means? It don't mean a planet. What it means is wandering stars. There's literally the eye at night who's trained to study the stars. And you know there's, especially in this day and time that we're preaching about in this book tonight, they knew the night sky. They knew the constellations. They knew the stars. They didn't have GPS. They didn't even have a compass. They used the stars to guide them. And that's what Jude is referencing. There were certain bodies there that you could see, but it may appear over here on this night, but be in another area of the sky on another night. They moved to and fro. They were unstable in their position, is what he's talking about. And so when he talks about wandering stars, that's just exactly what he's talking about. The North Star will always be in its position. It's always there. But these stars seem to move around on them. And if a person leaned on them heavily to dictate the course of travel, the way we need to travel in our journey, no tellings where they'd wind up. And what Jude's telling you, if you lean on these false teachers to dictate the course that you need to travel in your Christian life, no tellings where you might wind up. No telling where you might wind up. He said they're wandering stars. He said they've got some reservations made, though. They're wandering right now, and ain't no telling where they'll be tonight or tomorrow night. But he said on the last night, he knows where they'll be. He said, to whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. How black is the blackness of darkness? It's darker than you can possibly imagine. It's darker than you can possibly imagine. Do you know the Bible speaks of hell being a place of outer darkness? I've never seen it and certainly never experienced it, but I've heard that in some of the military branches, part of the training that they do nowadays is they will put those soldiers in a place of total darkness, some sort of a capsule or something like that. They place them in, and the people that have experienced that say that something unimaginable comes over you when you experience that. To not know which way is up or down, or left or right. Most of us have never experienced total darkness. We think we have. We cut off all the light and we think there's darkness, but there's a little light slipping in under the door, some coming from somewhere. No, we're talking about total and absolute darkness. And they say when you experience that, that something very abnormal comes over you. And they say that some of the very strongest, toughest, mentally strong, not just physically strong, but mentally strong soldiers can only handle it for a very brief number of minutes until they're screaming and crying. Imagine that, 45 seconds. He said it felt like eternity. Reckon what eternity will feel like in outer darkness. These folks got reservations. Yeah. Yeah. These fellows have reservations made for it. They're apostate. They've turned their back on God to a place of no return. They're never coming back. They're never getting saved. They're apostates. They hate God. They hate the church. They serve their own lust. And there's reservation made for them to reprobate mind. And listen, when God gives one over to reprobate mind, you can forget it, buddy. There's no place of return from that. And those, it says it's reserved from the blackness of darkness. Those last two words are what's chilling forever. And you just heard testimony of what 45 seconds done to a soldier. What about forever? What about forever? But you tell me, what else could God do with them? What else could God do with an apostate? What else could God do with a false teacher who tread underfoot the blood of Christ and became, as we talked about Sunday, Christ merchants, who took Christ and His lovely name and His gospel and turned it into a way of gaining filthy lucre? What else could God do with them other than cast them into outer darkness? But that's not all that's there for them. While they're tormented in outer darkness forever and ever, there's also a flame. The fire's never quenched. It's a place where the fire's never quenched and the worm dieth not. I'll tell you, it's a terrible thing to fall into the hands of an angry God. All right, we'll pick up next Wednesday night, Lord willing, right here in verse number 14, where it deals with Enoch, the seventh from Adam, and his prophecy. That's interesting. Read your New Testament this week, and I want you to come back and tell me how many other references you find to any of Enoch's writings in your New Testament. Tell me how many you find, all right? All right, let's bow our head and pray and dismiss. Father, thank You tonight for loving us like You do. Thank You for mercy, grace, and goodness. And God, we recognize tonight as much as we can that we live in dark days, dark hour. And Lord, even the so-called Christian world is cumbered about, Lord, it's crippled by false teachers. Everybody seems to be interested in health and wealth and all of those things that benefit them. Nobody seems to be interested in serving the Lord and bringing honor and glory to Him. But God, help us to stay the course. Help us to remain faithful. Help us to remain true. God, help us to live our lives as a testimony to the grace of God. And Lord, if that means suffering, then let suffering come. If that means trials, let trials come. But Lord, whatever You allow into our life, Lord, all that we ask is that You allow the Lord Jesus Christ to get glory through everything that comes into our life. God, help us as a body of believers to be ever vigilant and aware of these false teachers as they creep in. Lord, help us not be deceived. Lord, help us not to be taken back. Help us to recognize when we see it try to creep in that we might face it as early as possible. We ask it, Lord, in Jesus' precious name. Amen.